Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavaditamastu Madhidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. We'll chant the first verse, and then I'm going to say a few more things about the first verse, then we'll go on to the second one. So just repeat after me. Om, Om, Pratasmarami, Vritisam, Spuraratma, Tattvam. Om, Pratasmarami, Vritisam, Spuraratma, Tattvam. Satchit Sukham, Paramaham, Sakatin, Turiyam. Satchit Sukham, Paramaham Sagatin Turiyam. Yet Swapna Jagra Shishuptam Avaiti Nityam. Yet Swapna Jagra Shishuptam Avaiti Nityam. Tad Brahma Nishkalamaham. Tad Brahma Nishkalamaham. Nachabhuta Sangaha. Nachabhuta Sangaha. Pratasmarami. In the morning, pratah, in the morning, I contemplate, I bring to my mind, the Atma-tattvam, the truth of myself, the Atma-tattvam, the truth of myself, which is manifest, samspurat, which is shining, which is manifest, riddhi, in my buddhi, in my heart. That Atma-tattvam, that truth of myself, which is Sat-Chit-Sukham, which is Sat, which is pure being, which is Chit, which is consciousness, which is Sukham, which is Ananda. The Sat-Chit-Ananda, Satyam-Yanam-Anantam, Sat-Chit-Ananda, Sat-Chit-Sukham. The fullness, the Ananda, the fullness of myself. The Sat-Chit-Ananda of myself. That self, I contemplate on every morning. Where do I find it? That which is manifest there in my buddhi, shining in my mind. That which is Paramahamsa Gatim Turiyam. Paramahamsa Gatim. That which is the abode for the Paramahamsa, for the sadhus, for the jnanis, for those who have self-knowledge. The gati is, that's what's been accomplished. In other words, through their jnanam, they now recognize. Gati means that which is the means for achieving something, but it's also the thing achieved. And so here for the sannyasis, for the Paramahamsa sannyasis, means those that have jnana nishtha, for those people, that nature of myself, the atma-tattvam, which is just pure consciousness, limitless consciousness, which is the sukham, is the ananda, the limitless fullness of myself, that self is me. And so the ahankara, the I thought, my self-identity, what we call the abhimana, you know, the self-identity, is with me, not with something else. I don't have a sense of myself being my mind or myself being my physical body. This is what we call the ahankara, the I notion, your I thought. Everybody has an I thought. You have thoughts of knowledge, you have determinative thinking, you have memories. You have emotions, you have fluctuating mind. You also have what we call an ahankara. The ahankara is what identifies your own still, simple presence with anything that it's able to identify with. So I would say, I can identify with this physical body. I can say, I am this physical body, right? There's what we call, what they call Hridaya Granthi there. It's a knot of the heart. You've heard this term probably, the knot of the heart. It means that my buddhi, my mind, takes the I am thought, which is Satchitananda, to say I am an existent conscious being, and it identifies with it, it superimposes it onto my body. So I am my body. Right? So there's kind of a red hot iron ball syndrome there. It's called anyonya adhyasa. It's a superimposition where I take my own presence to be one with this body and this body to be one with myself. It's the same with my thoughts. I can say, I am happy, I am sad, I am agitated. It's not that my mind is agitated and I illumine my mind. It's I am agitated. So I identify with my mind, and then I take on the nature of this agitated mind, and the mind takes on the nature of me, the conscious being. I become a red-hot iron ball. I become just this one thing. That's the ahankara. For a jnani, for one who has self-knowledge, there can be an as-though ahankara, where you can say, I am agitated, or my body is tired, or I'm tired, or whatever. You talk like this. But for you, the aham, the I, resolves not into the body, or not into the mind, but it resolves into the atma, into the self. So there's a differentiation, there's a distinction that takes place there. Like when we were doing the meditation, when you slow everything down, you can recognize your own silent, still presence. And you can recognize all of the changing thoughts that are taking place, the emotions that are rising and setting, all of the sounds that you're hearing. But at the same time, as all of those perceptions are taking place, you recognize you, your own presence, which is not doing anything. It's not engaged in all of the perceptions. The perceptions are taking place, but your conscious being is still simply abiding in the midst of all of those sensations. And that being is you. That's where the me is. The me is not something, the I is not something that you're looking at. It's not a thought that's coming and that's rising and setting. It's not an emotion that's passing through. The I is the one we can say like this, the I, the self, is the one for whom all of these sensations are. But when we slow it all down, you recognize that you are just simply being. You are simply being. And the one who is simply being is not some distant abstract concept. It's actually you. When you're sitting in meditation and enjoying the silent presence of yourself, you don't think of that as somebody else. You think of that as you. In fact, when we meditate, part of the reason we meditate is to silence all of this external noise, to slow everything down, just so I can be with myself, not so that I can be with somebody else. In fact, the more we slow down, the more that the one, let's put it this way, the one as though left standing is only me. And we notice the silent, abiding presence of that self. Like when we ask, once that silent, abiding presence of me is there, and then you ask, is there any lack here? Is there any lack in me, in this silent, abiding presence? Is there something in it I want to change? Is there something I want to replace? Is there something missing? Should I fill it up with something else? And the answer really is invariably no. No. There's nothing to be added. That is me. In fact, that is the beloved. That's myself, the one, in fact, that I'm always in every action, in fact, trying to protect. The sense of me, when you say I am or me, is always that. You slow it down, slow everything down, and you just recognize that, what you recognize is actually this me that is here right now in this room listening, or I'm talking, you know. Those are all sensory images. They're all coming and going. But they're coming and going in this very stable presence, which is me. And then you say, this me, not all the comings and goings that are actually illumined or taking place in that presence, but this presence itself, does it need anything? Is it lacking? You say, no, there's nothing to do. There's nothing I can do or even conceive of doing to it. So now, for the sannyasi, for the jivanmukta, for the person that has jnanam, the aham, the I, is the I of that self. It's not the I of a superimposition. That self which is identified with the mind, that self which is identified with the body, Rather, it's of that self alone, whose presence is always exactly the same. And that presence is something which doesn't lack anything. It doesn't feel a lack. So here, that's the Paramahamsa Gatim. That's the Gati. That's the abode. That's the resolve. That's what has been recognized by the Jivanmukta, the one who has knowledge. And that one is initially, anyway, in the Mandukya Upanishad, called the fourth. The fourth means, if I take all of Turiyam means the fourth. If I take all of my experiences, I can divide the whole gamut of my experiences into the waking state, means what I experience as a physical body here with sense organs, what all the experiences that I can have through my sense perception, which form vrittis, thought modifications in my mind, all of these experiences take place in the waking state. I need this body to be awake and present to my experience that I'm in the waking state. The second one, the first experience, that's called the jagrat. The swapna is the dream state. The dream state is differentiated from the waking state because in the dream state, I don't require my sense organs. I don't require the use of my body, this physical body, to be active in this waking state using my sense organs. Rather, in the dream state, through my mind, I'm experiencing, I'm creating a world of my own. And I take another body of that same dream, in that same dream material, I take another body, right? And I have just a different level of experience. That's the difference between waking and dream. Waking requires my sense perception, my being grounded in this reality through my sense perception and my organs of action. The dream state, I'm really making use of the chitta, of the memory, right, to create another type of world, a subtle world, which when I'm in it doesn't seem like a subtle world, it seems like the world that I'm in, right? I don't think, when I'm in the middle of a dream, I don't think, oh, this is an interesting dream, you know, unless I'm pulling out of the dream. If I'm in the dream, then that is my world, but from the standpoint of the waking state, I clearly distinguish between the level of reality of the dream state, being a subtle reality, and this being more of a physical reality. That's the second state. The third state, and so anyway, a lot of experiences take place in the dream world, just like a lot of experience takes place in the waking state. The third state is the deep sleep state. And that too, we have to count as an experience, because we know that I had a deep sleep last night, you know, and that time I was really sound asleep. I wasn't dreaming, you know, I wasn't awake, I wasn't dreaming. My mind was just in an unmanifest condition, you know, and all was well with me. Ignorance is bliss. Full, complete ignorance, didn't know anything. And I slept really, really well. So we describe it. So this one, waking state, dream state, deep sleep state. We say these three states of experience, in a sense, capture all of the experiences that I can have within duality. And we'll say, even say in the waking state, I can have my physical body, my sense organs, I'm awake, but I'm daydreaming. When I'm daydreaming, at that time, I'm not having an experience of the waking state. I have to come back, you know? So we call that the dream state. In the deep sleep state, you could also say coma and those kind of being knocked unconscious, those type of situations, all fit into the deep sleep state category. Whereas daydreaming, imagination, active imagination, all of these type of things where I'm really just involved with my subtle body, those we put into the dream state. And then we have the waking state. So these three states, 1, 2, 3, I am not any one of those three states. I am the Turiya. I am the fourth. Right? I'm not the waking state. I'm not the dream state. I'm not the deep sleep state. I can also say I'm not the waker, I'm not the dreamer, I'm not the deep sleeper. Why would we say that? Because actually, I am the waker, and I am the dreamer, and I am the deep sleeper. So how can I say I'm not? How can I even say I'm the fourth? Well, it's because I am the waker when the waking state is there. But the, when the waking state is replaced by the dream state, right, then I'm no longer the waker. Now I'm the dreamer. Right? The waking state is replaced by the dream state, means the waker is replaced by the dreamer. Right? But I'm the waker and I'm the dreamer. You see the problem there? I'm the waker and I'm the dreamer. That means I can't be either the waker or the dreamer. Because when the waker is with a waking state, the dreamer isn't there. And when the dreamer is with a dream state, the waker isn't there with the waking state. And yet, I am the waker and I am the dreamer. Right? Even I'll say, I'm awake right now. Last night I slept well. You know? And I did have a dream. I dreamt. I was in deep sleep. And the day before I was awake. What does that mean? It's true. I am the waker. I am the dreamer. I am the deep sleeper. But the waker is not there when the dreamer is there, and the dreamer is not there when the deep sleeper is there. And yet I'm all three. So that's an interesting situation. I am the waker, dreamer, deep sleeper, and I am free of the waker, dreamer, deep sleeper. This is a viveka that needs to take place. I'll show you how it's such a simple thing. We don't think about it like this, but it's a very simple thing. If I say I have, in the waking state, I'm having an emotion. Say I'm feeling sad. Okay. Now I say, I am sad. I'm feeling so sad. Yeah. And then that sadness, for whatever reason, somebody comes, a friend comes, whatever happens, the sadness just goes away. And now I'm feeling really pleased. Now I'm pleased. But I was sad. And I was sad, right? But now I'm pleased. So the one who is sad is now the one who is pleased. Which means I can't be either sad or pleased. Because when the pleased one is there, the sad one is gone. Right? They negate each other. But from my vantage point, it's absolutely reasonable for me to be sad and then for me to be pleased. What's interesting about this is that the language that I use, and how to say this, even without any knowledge, I'm very clear that I, who was sad, am the I that is now pleased. I don't say somebody else was sad and they left. But I don't say that, I don't feel that way. If somebody was here who was really sad, they left, and now the pleased one has come, right? It's not, we don't think like that, that's not our experience. Our experience is, I was sad, now I am pleased. And this, I have the same self-identity, not that there's somebody else. But the problem is that in my mind, I haven't made a discrimination between my being and the experience that I'm having, right? The silent, stable, constant me that is present to the sad experience is the same silent, stable, constant me that is now present to the pleased experience. Because there's this identification that takes place, even though I never change. I still, even though I never change, I am the constant, I still go on endlessly being identified with the experiences that I'm having. So now, when we go to the waking dream and deep sleep, this gives us a good opportunity to kind of understand, to look at this phenomena in what I consider to be a really powerful way. Because when you're in the waking state, you have the waking experiences that you experience through this body and these sense organs. So in the waking state, I am the waker in this particular world, experiencing the world. There's a subject-object relationship. There's the individual experiencing the waking world, right? And I take myself, the me, to be this individual, this person here, experiencing this waking world. That's where my identity is. I am here as a waker experiencing this world. Now, when we move into the dream world, what has happened is that now not only do we have another set of experiences, the dream world experience, we also have another experiencer, the dream character within the dream. So here we have the waking character within the waking world. In the dream state, we have the dream character, whoever I'm identified with, within the dream world. See that? Now, I am the self of the waker, but I'm also the self of the dreamer. The dreamer who, through the dream sense organs, experiences the dream world. So, as I'm the self of this waker, the waker who has the physical body, the waking body with sense organs experiencing the waking world, I illumine this waking world. This is in reality. I illumine this waking world. I illumine this waking body. I illumine this waking mind. I illumine the waking sense organs, the waking mind, the waking emotions, the waking feelings, the waking I thought. I abide silently, right, stillly, present to all of the experiences that are contained in the waking world, which include the subject, the character within the waking world, and the object the waking world experienced. You see what's happening? This body, mind, sense organs is as much illumined in the waking world, right, as what the sense organs of this body, mind, sense organ illumine. And so, in fact, what we see is I'm freed. My being illumines the mind, the sense organs, and the body of the waker who is in the waking world. When I go to the dream world, I have the same thing. The dream world replaces the waking world. The dream character that I'm identified with in the dream world replaces the waking character that I'm identified with in the waking world. Both belong, the waker belongs to the waking world. The dreamer belongs to the dream world. I illumine both. And nothing happens to me. I'm the self of the waking world. I'm the self of the dream world. And I'm the self of the deep sleep world. What is the deep sleep world? Where the waking world and the dream world are collapsed. There's just pure ajnanam. There's no duality at all in the deep sleep world. But I don't experience death or non-existence in the deep sleep world. In fact, I look forward to it. This is really odd, don't you think? Let me just conk out. Let me just go into deep sleep. That's my... Some person says this a lot. I just want to go into deep sleep. Oh, I can't wait. It's only 8 o'clock. I wish it's too early for me to go to bed yet. I wish it was 8:30 or 9 so that I could just go to bed and go into deep sleep. So what happens in deep sleep? Well, the whole world of experience, all of it, is just vanishes. And I'm just with myself. Mm. So no problem. Mm. Everything else has gone into kind of an unmanifest condition, and so it causes no problems for me. I don't even have to be a knower. There's no knowership in deep sleep. So there's just my simple abiding presence without anything else happening. And we love it. We love it. Swamiji will go on and on about this, about how You know, when we make our bed very comfy, get a really good mattress, and then nice sheets and comforters, wonderful down pillows and everything, you know, and so that you can just crawl in and look forward to it. You crawl into your bed and get all snuggly and comfortable, and then just go to sleep. You love it. But there's no experience except for me, right? Everything else is in an unmanifest condition. I don't require anything to be me. And in fact, everything else can, in a sense, take away from me. And so here, Turiyam, which is initially called the fourth because I am the self, right? I am the pure self that is free of the waking state, free of the dream state, and free of the deep sleep state. So that's number four, the one who's free of these three states. But that Turiyam, that number four, Swamiji uses the example of a dollar bill, you know, has four quarters. The first quarter, then the second quarter, then the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. Right, but now we've got a dollar. We've got one thing. And so here, you've got one self, right? And we recognize it's not really the fourth. That this one self that I am is the self of the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. And at the same time is completely untouched by both. By all three, completely untouched by all three. And that's, it has to be. If I were attached in any way to any one of those three states, I couldn't get out of the state. I'd be stuck. You know? Say me, to who I am, was really attached in some way to this waking state experience. Then when that waking state experience is not being experienced anymore, I wouldn't be being experienced anymore. Because I'm attached to it. I belong to it. But since I don't belong to it at all, when that experience is there, is replaced by the dream experience, I experience no shift at all. There's no shift in my being. It's very fluid. This world can be replaced by this world, can be replaced by this world, by that world. That's all fine with me, because nothing happens to me at all. The same is true when I say you have the experience of waking up from a dream. You're waking up from a dream. That can be an incredible, say you have having a very vivid dream, you know, you're totally engaged in this dream and something happens, alarm clock or whatever, and that dream vanishes just like that. The whole dream vanishes. All of the characters in the dream, the setting of the dream, and you. Your dream body, gone, completely annihilated, gone, like that. And there hasn't been the slightest ripple in your presence. Zero. It's just this experience has vanished. But you remain the same. So that, to what we call the Turiyam, you know, he says now, that Turiya, that fourth, is that which in the waking jagrat, the swapna jagrat, in the order they put it here, the swapna, the dream state, the waking state, the deep sleep state, that which illumines it, that which illumines that. The next word is nityam. Nityam means free from time. That atma tattvam, the truth of myself, is timeless. And it is what illumines the waking, dream, and deep sleep state. I am that Brahman. I am that self which is Satchit-Ananda, which is just pure, the pure being which is me, the being itself which is consciousness and which is Sukham. Sukham means it's unhindered completely, limitless. Sukham Ananda means limitless, that your being has nothing limiting it in any way, nothing tainting it or putting any type of limitation on. It's absolutely free. That's what we mean by the ananda. So that ananda, which is being called Turiyam, that I am that, and that I is Brahman, is that self which is absolutely limitless. I am not, in fact, any of these Bhuta Sangha. I'm not any of the bhutas, any of these elements. The elements, the space, air, fire, water, earth, means this whole creation and everything in it. I am totally free of that. Rather, I am that Brahman, that limitless me, which is nishkalam, has no parts at all. Mm. Nishkalam means I am partless. Mm. There's nothing in the creation that's partless. Everything in the creation is limitless parts. Everything can be infinitely divided. There's nothing but parts here. But here, the Atma, the self that you are, is nishkalam. It is Brahman. It is limitless and absolutely free from parts. Nothing can touch it. Now, this nothing can touch it, when we did the meditation, you notice that in terms of all of the experiences that are coming and going, nothing touches you. So any experience of just the simple thing of seeing that sounds take place in the silent awareness of yourself. The sounds don't disrupt the silence. Sounds don't disrupt the awareness. It's the same if you watch your thoughts. The thoughts are coming and going, multitasking. Thoughts are coming from all different directions, you know, with feelings and images and whatnot. But as this type of kaleidoscope of a show is taking place, you just remain absolutely untouched. Well, that untouched self is untouched in the waking state, untouched when there's the dream state, untouched when there's the deep sleep state, untouched. It is limitless. It's not messed with in any way by the creation. The Buddha Sangha means all of the elements of the creation on every level, subtle and gross. So that self, on every level of our experience, needs to be differentiated. It needs to be consciously differentiated because the superimposition is so much. Okay? So now, that's that verse that we worked on last week. So let's start with this next one, number two. Pratarad pajami manasam vachasam agamyam. Pratarad pajami manasam vachasam agamyam. Vacho vipanti nikila yadanukrahena. Vacho vipanti nikila yadanukrahena. Yanneti neti vachanair nigama avochan. Yanneti neti vachanair nigama avochan. Tam deva deva majamachutamahuragriyam. Tam deva deva majamachutamahuragriyam. Pratar pajami. Pratar pajami manasam vachasam agamyam. Manasam vachasam agamyam. Vacho vipanti nikila. Vacho vipanti nikila. Yadanukrahena. Yadanukrahena. Yanneti neti vachanair. Yanneti neti vachanair. Nigama avochan. Nigama avochan. Tandeva devam. Tandeva devam. Ajamachitam. Ajamachitam. Ahuragriyam. Ahuragriyam. So Sunday. Pratar bhajami manasam vachasam agamyam. Vachaha vipanti nikilaha yat anugrahena. Yat na iti na iti. Bachanaihi nigamaha avochan. Tam deva devam ajam achitam. Ahuhu agriyam. So now here, instead of pratasmarami, it says pratar bhajami. I worship in the morning. I worship pratar bhajami. Manasam, of the mind. Vachasam of words, agamyam, that which cannot be reached by the mind. In English, we'd say that which cannot, that which is unreachable for the mind, and that which is unreachable for words. That from which words come back and the mind comes back. That which can't be reached by the mind and that which can't be reached by words. Okay? I worship that one. Vachaha, the words, vachaha, that's in the nominative singular, vacha, the words, vibhanti, shine variously, manifest, nikilaha, vachaha, nikilaha, with all words shine, yed anugrahena, by whose grace. So it says, in the morning, I worship that one which can't be reached by the mind or by words, but by whose grace, yed anugrahena, all words are manifest, are illumined. Mm. Right? Then it says, that yen neti neti, naiti 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 vachanaihi nigamaha avochan, that which the nigama are the Vedas and the sampradaya, the teaching tradition, and of the Vedic teaching tradition and the Vedas, you say that which the Vedas avochan reveal. Avochan means tell, shravana, they tell. That which the Vedas, reveal, that which the Vedas reveal, vachanahi, by the words, not this, not this. Ever heard neti neti? Not this, not this, not this, not this. It's part of the whole teaching methodology. So that which that one which the Vedas reveal, by the words, neti neti, not this, not this. Tam deva deva, that deva deva, That God of gods means the one who illumines David, the one who illumines the luminaries. What are the luminaries? Are the sense organs and the mind, right? The minds are the sense organs and the mind are the organs of knowledge. So the conscious being that illumines those sense organs and the mind, David Devam, that one who is Ajam, who is unborn, who is Achyutam. Achyutam means that which can't, that which can't be changed or diminished in any way, achyutam. Ahuhu, they say, that which they say is, they say ahuhu. Who says? The wise ones, the paramahamsas, the ones who have jnanam, those who know. They say that one who is devadevam, ajam, achyutam, and who is agriyam. Agriyam means the cause of all causes, the first cause. Means the one because of whom all of this is. So that's how the verse reads. Now, each verse itself is bringing the mind to the vision of the whole. Right. That's why each verse is a kind of a complete meditation in itself. So here, it's very common to that because of which the mind and the words is mind and speech are known, the mind and speech can't reach. So this is the idea of that. For instance, when we're sitting in contemplation and you're watching your mind, you're aware of your mind, you're aware of the thoughts in your mind. What you recognize is that in fact my being is present, is the conscious being, because of which the thought is known. Right? The thought is known. Right? Because of what? Because of the conscious being. Because of consciousness, the thought is known. You remove the thought, consciousness away, the thought can't be known. So the question is, where does the consciousness reside? Where does the consciousness, because of which the thought is known, where does it reside? You can't say it resides in the thought. Because if it resided in the thought, when the thought leaves, then the consciousness would go with it, right? Because the conscious being resides in the thought. But that's not your experience. Your experience is that the conscious being is the stable being in which the thoughts come and go. Right? So understand like this. Any thought you have, this is the manas, this is mind, any thought you have is known when the thought is present. But every thought that you have has a prior condition of not being present and a posterior condition of not being present. You're only present for a moment in the middle here. Okay? Now, if consciousness belonged to it, here this thought has come into being, is present, and goes out of being. But the thought should remain being known if it had consciousness. Right? If the thought itself had consciousness, then the thought would always be known. You see what I'm saying? If the thought had being, the thought would always be. But that isn't what happens. What happens is the thought manifests in consciousness and goes out of manifestation. So, whether you say that is true with the mind or with any words that you use, words also that you use are used, this is a slightly different, but you words also have meaning and direction. They're used to label things, right? So this word, like if I say lamp, that word lights up the lamp. It goes with the lamp. Table goes with the table. You know? Any word, in fact, even abstract words that I use, say if I use the word eternal, eternal also goes with our relative concept of eternality because the word exists, right? The word exists, and the word exists to label an abstract concept that we have within duality. That's all the words are like that. Agreed? Mm-hmm. All the language that we have is meant to label experiences, abstract or otherwise, that we have within this creation. They could be words that are used to label different types of thoughts in my mind. They are words that can be used to label feelings. They can be used to label abstract ideas. But all of these, all of the words that we use are directed at this domain of experience that we have that is primarily gained through our sense perception and any inferences or presumptions that we have that are based on that sense perception. So our words have this domain of our experience, of the experienced world, this is their habitat, let me put it that way. this is their habitat, okay? The words themselves, which are illumined by awareness, don't have a capacity to label an awareness which is the awareness that is illumining them. The awareness that is illumining them, right, is outside of their domain. Like, can a word say, is there a word for, let me put it this way, is there a word for awareness? Yeah, we have the word awareness. But what is its domain? What is the domain of our word awareness or our word consciousness? It would say, well, okay, awareness. Awareness means I'm aware of something. And so awareness exists, the word awareness exists within a subject-object relationship. That's why some Buddhist schools, when they're only relating to what we experience within this domain of duality, they have the word awareness. Vijnanam, they have a word awareness. But they only mean by it awareness of something, because that's what the word means here, or consciousness of something. It's consciousness in relation to something, because that's the only way that we can use the word. Similarly, a word like existence. We have the word existence, you know, but what does the word mean? That word has to take its meaning from the relative world where things either exist or they don't exist, right? Like, this cup exists now, but if I drop it and break it, like we broke Edward's cup the other day.
His broke cup, my handle.
This handle broke off of his cup. So we have this cup as long as it is here, so this cup is, you know, but this cup can go out of existence So existence is a word that's used only in relation to non-existence, right? It's a polar opposite. It either exists or it doesn't exist. What else? Because the word itself exists within duality. The word existence, we have no way for that word, for us, for that word to mean an existence which is itself a noun, free of both existence and non-existence in terms of the coming and going of objects in the creation. We have no such concept because that situation doesn't exist in the world, nor does a consciousness that is free of subject and object, knower and known, that doesn't exist in the world. And so when you use the word consciousness, it has to do with a subject-object relationship. When you use the word existence, it has to do with objects of one sort or another, even mental objects in form of thoughts or moods or emotions, or in reference to objects in the world, right? We're talking about the coming and going of them. That's how we use the word existence and non-existent. And so words themselves are helpless here. Words themselves are not able to land on or to illumine the self. Right? They're not able to illumine the self because the words themselves are only defined, they're only given meaning within the world of relative existence, within the world of change. And so here it says, you know, I worship that one that can't be reached by the mind or by words, agamyam. It can't fall into the sphere of mind, of the mind and words. How can it fall into the sphere of the mind? Right? Because the mind is only forming thought modifications based upon what? Objects, perceptions, either on a subtle level or on a physical level. They're perceptions. Perceptions exist, are generated by our relationship with the world. And so this mind isn't able to objectify the self that illumines it, right? The words aren't able to objectify the self because of which the words shine. So the words themselves can't objectify the self. The mind can't objectify the self. And that, so what does it say here? It says, make it into a nice sentence. I worship that one that can't be reached by the mind or by speech, but by whose grace all speech itself is illumined, all speech itself is known. All thoughts, you can extend that to all thoughts, all feelings, all moods, all emotions, all names themselves are known. So the conscious being that lights up the mind, right? Consciousness lights up the mind. The mind doesn't light up consciousness. That's a very big thing to understand. Mm-hmm. I light up the mind. The mind doesn't light up me. In fact, there's never a time when I don't light up the mind. As long as the mind's there, if the mind's there, it's lit up by me. Right? So the mind enjoys the consciousness that illumines it. But the scope of the mind, even though the consciousness totally abides and pervades that mind, the scope of the mind looks out. Right? It doesn't look in, it looks out. Right? And it also doesn't have its own luminary. Say consciousness illumines the mind. The mind doesn't have its own consciousness to turn around and look at the consciousness and say, oh, well, how are you? I'm so glad to meet you. There aren't two consciousnesses for the mind to be able to do that. Consciousness illumines the mind. The mind has its own consciousness, turns around and illumines the self. That's not the situation. And so what is the situation for the mind then is that, you know, it never does not enjoy consciousness, and at the same time doesn't know, because it never doesn't enjoy consciousness, how is it going to know itself as different as though from consciousness? What does the mind say? just says, I am the conscious being. Why shouldn't it? It doesn't realize, except when being taught, it becomes obvious. But initially it's not going to say, I'm known, the mind talking, I'm known. Every thought I have, every thought is known. Every thought comes and goes. You know? I'm transitory. I'm transitory. But the consciousness is not. You know, the one that illumines the transitory mind isn't transitory. And so the mind has to make that distinction. It has to then, in the end, what it has to say is that, you know, the self that is my truth is free of me, the mind. The self that is my very being, the conscious me, is free of the mind. Then what has to happen is that you have to realize that the me, the self, that the mind has said is me, it has to realize that the me that it enjoys is free of it. See what I mean? It's like saying the mind has to say, I am totally dependent upon me, the self, which is consciousness, which is the I. But the I, the me, is totally free of the thought. The thought depends upon the self, but the self, the I, doesn't depend upon the mind. The mind depends upon the self is totally free of the mind. When the mind realizes that, it's a huge relief. It's a huge relief because now the mind has a benign home. Because your self doesn't lack. What happens is that the mind recognizes that once it's made this distinction, it recognizes that the self which doesn't lack is full and free in spite of me. In spite of me, which can have all different kinds of feelings and pains and whatnot, you know. But those feelings, those pains, those problems take place in a self which is itself whole. And so I can even say, I am always whole, my mind's having a problem. I am whole, I am full, I am complete, you know, and my mind can rest in that wholeness and fullness while having a problem, you know, while feeling sad, while feeling hurt, while feeling worried. That worry, sad, hurt, whatever it is being held by a self which is not tainted or touched by it, and which is by its own nature full and complete. That's why this viveka, this discrimination, is so vitally important, because without it, I'm just like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, just like a boat, you know, being tossed at sea in a storm. Just tossed here and back and there and back and there, but you don't have any control over it. But the mind is kind of like that. You can't just say, oh mind, I want you from this point on, just think like this. Just be like this. Be fine. Be better for you. Even a Jivan Mukta can't say that. Only thing Jivan means one who has jnanam. Can't say that. They don't need to say that. Right? Because it doesn't make any difference. The tossing and turning of whatever happens to be happening in the mind is taking place in a self that is whole and complete. And the ahankar, the I, goes with that whole and complete self. And so the turbulence, if there is any turbulence in the mind, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because I'm not turbulent. And then, of course, when the mind recognizes a non-turbulent self that it can relax into and whose nature is fullness and it can't hurt or harm in any way, that mind also relaxes. You know, it relaxes because now it's found that stable home that is whole and complete, no matter what. The samsari, that's never the situation. I'm never whole and complete no matter what. It's I'm whole and complete for this moment and I know I can't hang on to it. It's a very insecure position. That's really the difference between in some very fundamental way between knowledge and ignorance. One person is whole and complete no matter what, and the other was whole and complete for the moment. You know, knowing that it can't be hung on to, that's a devastating situation. So here then, so quickly, we'll do more of this verse next week. Yaneti neti vachanar nigama avochan. So because the words themselves can't illumined, can't land on the self, how then does the Upanishad, how do the Vedas teach this? How do they teach? How do they make you recognize the self? By differentiating the self from what it is not. It's not this, it's not this, it's not this. You strip off from the self the things that are illumined by it, so to speak, you know? And what is left is the luminary. It's not that consciousness needs to be illumined. You don't need a mind to look at consciousness. You don't need sense organs to turn around and look at consciousness. Consciousness is consciousness. It's self-evident. You are self-evident. But the thing is, there's been a misidentification on the part of the mind. And so the Upanishad has to come in and make that differentiation. Oh, mind, you are the illumined, not the illuminator. You know? The feeling that you have is something that's illumined, you know? What is the nature of you, the one who's illumining? Remove the things that are being illumined, and then you are left. Then the Upanishad will make a positive assertion, you are that one. That one, you know, that's been differentiated from all of these things that have been pointed out to you as not this, not this, not this. This is known to you, this is known to you, this is known to you. This comes into your awareness, goes out of your awareness, this appears and disappears, this appears and disappears. This is something known to you. Put it to the side and see who's left. Look at what we do in contemplation. It's always differentiation, 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 until all that's left standing, so to speak, is your being. And then you turn toward that, what's left. Once all of these things that have been differentiated have been differentiated from it. And so then he says, so the Upanishads teach in this way. And then what is left is that deva-devam, that conscious being that illumines all the luminaries, which itself, all of the sense organs in the mind, the deva, the consciousness that illumines those things that are the luminaries, sense organs in mind. And that consciousness is ajam. It's unborn because it's not objectifiable. And it's achyutam. It's something which is changeless and which is the first cause. So those two lines we'll do next week. Let's stop there. Just want to make sure you have the whole verse and then we'll unfold the next two lines. Okay. Purnamidah, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamudachyate, Purnasya Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
Yeah,
Yato Vacho Nivartante.
Yeah,
that's in the type 3, right? Yato Vacho Nivartante. Namasasaha. Aprapya Namasasaha. Is that the whole thing? Tell me. Yato Vacho
Nivartante.
Yeah. That's the main part. Yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasasaha, having not reached, together with the mind.
Right. And does it say that from which words come back?
Yato vacho nivartante, that from which the words return,
right.
Saha manasasaha, together with the mind, aprapya, having not reached.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, there's two verses here, and in the first verse, it says, I contemplate on reality. And on the second verse, it says, I worship.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's the difference? I worship the Atma. One is
it's like doing prayers, or I just bow down, I pranam. The third one is namami. They're just different forms. I'm contemplating on it. I'm holding it as, you know, worship it. It's the most important to me, like in prayer. Mm-hmm. I prostrate to it.
So it's not really distinct activities?
Just different feelings. You know, I contemplate on it.
Yeah.
And just like I worship Ishwara.
Yeah.
I prostrate to it. I don't know what else to say.
That almost sounds like sort of like leaning into absorption in a sense. Like I contemplate it, recognize it, and kind of worship it in a sense of like that dissolving yourself in Ishwara in a way, you know?
Namami is also the resolution of the ahankara into the into Ishwara also.
We talked about thoughts. Where do our thoughts come from?
Well, where do thoughts come from? They come from the whole jiva upadi, actually. You know, they're not going to come from really outside of that. That's all part of Ishwara. The jiva is part of Ishwara. But the thoughts come out of from the mind, the subtle body that has, you know, well, I could go into it like that. Say the mind itself, the subtle body, is made of, I don't know if this is helpful, but anyway, I'll do it.
Yeah,
okay. We say the subtle body is made of sattva. If maya is sattva, rajas, and tamas, the subtle body is made of sattva. The sattva aspect of the subtle body is the mind and the sense organs. Right? Then the rajas aspect of the subtle body, you know, are the organs of action and the prana. And then the tamas aspect goes into the making of this physical body, goes through a process of grossification. And so now, if we take that subtle aspect and we call it the mind, then they say, okay, this mind, the mind that you have, the antakarana, it has four different types of thoughts. That's its function. So what is the mind? The mind is something that thinks. How does it think? It has four different types of thoughts. It has the ahankara, the I thought. It's got the intellect. It's got the fluctuating, the manas, the fluctuating mind. It's got the memory. And all those are just four major categories of thoughts that all thoughts can come under. So then you say, what thinks? Well, the only way you can answer that, well, the mind thinks. Okay? What is the mind? Well, the mind is part of the subtle body. What is the subtle body? Well, the subtle body is what really makes a jiva because it reflects consciousness. You know, well, why does it do that? Well, because it's part of the maya upadi. And the jivas, you know, are part and parcel of that maya upadi. And those jivas have the capacity to think. By jivas, I mean these sukshma shariras that are transmigrating. Your body, like this is a physical body, but this physical body, I'm now as a jiva or transmigrating sukshma sharira, I take this body, when that karma wears out, I transmigrate again and again and again, taking other physical bodies. So now say, if you say, who thinks, what thinks? Well, the only way we can really answer that, because thinking takes place, is to locate the place where the thinking takes place. Right? That's what else can we do? So to locate it, this is how they locate it. In the subtle body, the sattvic aspect of the five subtle elements makes it for the mind and the sense organs, and it is the mind that thinks. How does it think? Well, it has these four types of thoughts. You know, those are the categories that it's capable of. Oh, what about emotions? How do emotions take place? Well, we know emotions take place because we experience them. Where do we experience them? We experience them in the mind. What differentiates one emotion from another emotion? What causes these differing emotions? Well, what causes them really is that the mind itself is capable of reaction. It's capable of tension and relaxation, right? In different circumstances. When the mind is more relaxed, then those are all of those emotions, you know, and they can be more relaxed in this way, more relaxed in this way, a little even more relaxed. These generate all of the positive emotions. what generates the negative emotions are stress and tension in the mind. So if the mind is stressed this way, you could feel agitation, stressed a little bit more, you could feel annoyance, stressed a little bit more in this other way, you feel dislike, really stressed, you feel, you know, hatred, you feel hopeless in terms of satisfying your desires, the mind gets into a state of despair. But all of these states have to do with stress and tension in the mind in relationship to your own being. That's how they explain these things. So then you have to ask, okay, now where do they take place? Well, they take place in the antahkarana, in the mind. Where do thoughts take place? They take place in the mind. There's nothing else to say. You know, where does the mind exist? It exists in the subtle body. Where does the subtle body exist? It exists in Ishvara. You know. But then from the standpoint of the self doesn't have emotions, it doesn't have thoughts. You know. It doesn't have an upadhi. From its own standpoint, the self is really that I am is the self in all beings. The self that I am is the self that illumines the whole Maya upadhi or the whole Ishvara. And that self is not thinking.
So then, do thoughts originate from the subtle body or from Ishvara? Or is it some from...
No, they originate from the subtle body. But you have to remember, the subtle body is not away from Ishvara. Right? And is part and parcel of all the laws of Ishvara. But the subtle body, the mind that you have, is generated from your subtle body. But what's causing those thoughts to be generated, as opposed to other thoughts... would have to do with the relationship that you've had with the whole. In other words, what have you perceived? What have you thought about? What karmas have you done? What type of relationships have you had with people? These create all kinds of thoughts. In fact, it's an important meditation also, which we've done before, but we'll spend more time on it. Especially powerful when you do this meditation with feelings. Why are you having this feeling now? Okay? So when you're having a feeling, I say you're having a feeling of sorrow. I use the negative ones because they're the ones we want to change. The ones we have to work on. So say you're having a feeling of sorrow. Then you can sit with that feeling of sorrow and say, well, what has brought this about? And then you say, well, it's because so-and-so said this to me, and then that hurt my feelings, and I felt like this. So that's the first thing. Now you've moved out, you know, the network has just expanded. You're feeling hurt because so-and-so said this to you. And you say, well, why did so-and-so say this to me? Well, because so-and-so had said this to him, and I'd said that to him, and that had caused that, and he was feeling angry because of that. He said that to me. So now we've expanded it. But you can keep expanding until what you start seeing is that all of these circumstances took place, were required to generate this feeling. So this feeling is actually a karmapala. It's something that's been produced. And you can see everything that went into the production of this feeling. Then you can say, actually, this is Ishvara's feeling. it comes from the laws of Ishvara that have produced this. Just like the laws of Ishvara, we can be playing around with these laws, but the laws themselves will produce these results. You know, like if you put a pot of water on the stove and turn on the fire, it'll boil. And that's because there's laws there.
Well, what happened to me in that picture?
In what picture?
Well, if it ends, the feeling ends up being Ishvara.
when the feeling ends up being Ishvara, as you go through this type of process, this body, mind, sense organs, all of the interactions that are involved, you see all of the things that go into producing the feeling. Mm. You know, it's complicated. All of the things that are involved in producing this feeling, the things that are involved are more than just you. In fact, it's hard for you to just produce a feeling. You go ahead, try. You know, there's a lot involved that allows for that feeling to be produced. And so, in a sense, it It frees you of responsibility for the feeling as though you're the creator of the feeling. You know, it gives the feeling more to Ishwara, and it gives you some space. You know, it's like you can give the feeling over to Ishwara and you can see why it happened. And then you can also see how you can do something to change that dynamic, which will then produce another feeling. It's like I'm boiling the water because I've got it on high. It's going to boil over, so I turn down the heat. You know, and then it just comes into a simmer. I can affect, but I can affect the results, but I can see that the things that are taking place because of laws. Mm-hmm. You know? Once you understand that, it gives you a little bit of distance, and you can also change your behavior. Mm. When you're changing your behavior, the kind of the response, you know, Ishwara's response changes. It's a nice meditation. Swamiji's done several of them. I really like them.
I'm having a lot of trouble trying to figure out how words, what words are. I mean, this is a rather large question. You know, like if there are all sorts of things that go into the answer of why is there this emotion, there's also a tremendous amount of things that go into the answer of what does this word mean? What is this word? You know, like it's there's so much riding on a word, you know, like, and the meaning of it is always so important and yet so kind of ephemeral or something like that. Because if it's a, like, existence, I think that comes from the idea of stan, which is this idea of state, and a million things that might have been expressed in many different ways, like through dance or something like that. Maybe that's where the real reality is more of, you know, in order to understand, because sometimes it seems as if words almost are arbitrary, you know, that and in some cases I think they are.
Well, it's true, in fact, sometimes at school, in the spiritual counseling class I have, I'll take a word and then, you know, in any type of word, and then have everybody define. We did it with non-dual. The word non-dual, because it's such a buzzword now. And everyone define what they, how they use that word. Which they had a real problem doing, because it's a word, but it's not usually a word that we really try to define. We just kind of know what it means somehow. So a lot of words are like that. Even in professions, we do this as an exercise in psychology, because so many psychologists are using the same set of words, but they're using it very, very differently. And so that's in teaching something like Vedanta, where the knowledge itself is taught through the use of words. You have to be very, very careful in defining and defining and defining and defining the use of that word, right? And then when the word is being used to point out the nature of yourself, then you have to be using a teaching methodology to be able to do that. Because the word itself doesn't point out yourself. There is no word that points out yourself. Mm. Because all the words that we use only point out something within relativity. So you can't really use words in their primary sense to define or point to your nature. And that's why you have to use the words in a particular way, the implied meaning of the words, and there's a whole teaching methodology. I'm going to go into that next week a little bit, because that last two lines of the verse are talking about this neti neti, not this, not this. That neti neti is just like a marker for the whole teaching methodology, you know. And it's done through negation and positive assertion, but we'll spend a class on it to see how that knowledge actually takes, but self-knowledge takes place through, how can self-knowledge take place through teaching when you can't see it, you can't point to it, and there's no words that can contain it. Mm-hmm. So the words have to be handled in a particular way that they're pointing to by using this, not this, not this.
These verses are really densely packed.
I know.
I mean, they're just...
Absolutely. Really, that's why I can spend a lot of time on any one verse with... There are only three verses, and you can memorize them and meditate on these verses, because each verse itself really contains the vision, you know? And then with the three together, it's really, really beautiful.
Can you expand on the term Paramahansa Gati that you...
Yeah, the word Gati comes from the root gam, which means to go. So there's, in Sanskrit itself, you can...
I'm going.
In Sanskrit, you can use a word like gati to mean it is reached by this, means it's the pathway or the means for getting there, that's gati. Gamyateya nena, by this it is reached. But gati also is the destination that is reached, right? So gati can mean the destination, the place that is reached, or the means for getting there. So here, the Paramahansa can mean the mumukshu, the seeker, but it's like a sannyasi, who's taken sannyasa in order to gain this knowledge. It's called vividisha sannyasa. They've taken sannyasa to gain this knowledge. And then they could be called Paramahansa because sooner or later they'll become one, right? So a person can be take sannyasa because sooner or later they will become really a sannyasi. A sannyasi is one who has sarva karma sannyasa, means they've renounced everything. The only reason why they can renounce everything is to realize that I'm free of everything. Because you can't renounce. How can you renounce everything? You've got a body, you have to eat, you have to breathe, you have to do things, you have to get up, you have to go places, you have to sleep, you know, you have to... There's things you have to do as long as you have a body. So to say sarva karma sannyasa, which means I'm free of all activity, I'm free of all action. There's only one who is free of all action, and that's the Atma. Okay, so people, a student, a mamukshu, one who desires liberation, can take sannyasa in order to gain this knowledge, in order to become a sarva karma sannyasi, right? In order to gain the knowledge, they take the sannyasa. Or the person is a sannyasi because they have knowledge, right? So same with Paramahamsa. You can say that person's a Paramahamsa. They're a sannyasi because they're going to be a sannyasi. They're mumukshu, though they will be a sannyasi, so you call them a Paramahamsa sannyasi. So you could say the Paramahamsa gatim, that which is to be gained by the sannyasi, right? That abode, that state, that accomplishment, which is to be gained by the sannyasi, or that means by the mumukshu, or that which is gained in the sense of knowledge by the sannyasi, by the one who has self-knowledge. And what is gained through knowledge by the sannyasi is that aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman. That is the state of being for a sannyasi. I am the whole, I am Brahman. Yeah. Or if you look at it for the mumukshu, it's everything that I do, all of the sadhana, you know, all of the shravana, manana, nididhyasana, all of the exposure to the teaching, and all of the things I do for purity of mind and all of that, that is so that I can gain that gati, which is what? Aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's the gati. It's either as the means or the end. The end of the end to be achieved. So the Paramahamsa gati is that turiyam, that fourth, which is the one that illumines timelessly, free of time, the waking dream and deep sleep state. And that is Brahman, which is itself nishkalam, free of all parts. Tad Brahma, that Tad Brahma, Nishkalamaham. I am that Brahman which is free of all parts, not this creation.
Is the word nati, is that a conjunction?
Na iti.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Not. Literally it means not. They say not this. Na iti means nope.
Teach tomorrow, university too?
Yeah, but only in the afternoon. It'll be all right.
That's true.